Welcome to Leaders Under Fire in Sports, brought to you by Culture in Sports. This is where leadership decisions, organizational culture, media pressure, and legal realities collide. Your hosts are legal expert Bob Boland, myself, crisis communication specialist Jeff Chatterton, and with leadership and culture expert Dr. Jeremy Piasecki. Together with our special guests, we break down the moments that put sports leaders under the microscope and what it really takes to respond with integrity, accountability, and impact. This is Leaders Under Fire in Sports. You've been listening to Leaders Under Fire in Sports by Culture in Sports. These moments under pressure don't just shape headlines, they shape people. They shape organizations and the cultures they leave behind. Thanks for joining me. I'm Jeff Chatterton, joined with Bob Boland and Dr. Jeremy Piasecki, and our special guests as we've examined what leadership looks like when it truly matters. If this conversation challenged the way you think about leadership in sports, we invite you to continue to learn with us at cultureinsports.com, because influencing positive change starts with how leaders respond when they're under fire.
Hey, welcome to back to Leaders Under Fire in Sports. We brought back an old friend, or maybe we should just say friend, because we don't want to comment on anybody's age around here. But Doug Logan has really done everything in sports, and he's been a wonderful contributor to this podcast and a number of things. But there's a big event coming up in the month of June, starting in the month of June, finishing a little bit later here in where I am in New York, but coming to cities all across North America. And it kind of comes to everything that we talk about with leaders under fire or the issues that we have today. And it's obviously the World Cup. Doug has led Major League Soccer in the United States as its first commissioner, its founding commissioner. He's also led an Olympic sport, USA Track and Field, onto the largest stage in the Olympics. So he's been acutely aware of what big events are around the world, in addition to the many he put together in his work outside of those two jobs. Sometimes some of the most exciting work he's done. But this World Cup looked to be one thing, and it looks like it's going to take place as a very different item. It was a trio of countries hosting the qualifying rounds for the first time ever: the United States, Mexico, and Canada. And who knew that relations between those three countries might deteriorate so quickly? Certainly not when this event was bid several years ago, and that maybe the worst relationship would be between the United States and Canada of all those things right now. So there's a lot going on casting around that. And Doug, I wanted to get your reaction. I don't want to keep talking about it, but you've expressed some feelings about this World Cup and maybe how it differs from World Cups in general.
Yeah, well, thank you, Bob. Thank you, Jeremy, for inviting me back again. And it's nice to see Jeff again. This event, this, as you used to call back in the NYU days, mega event, has taken on a characteristic that is, that has become, how can I say it gently, maybe odious. It has a pallor over it that is disturbing to someone who has spent the large portion of his professional life working in the vocabulary of sports and seeing sports as a great equalizer and a great interstitial tissue among classes and, yes, for the most part, egalitarian. It has taken on the pallor that is not new, has existed before. I mean, the Super Bowl is famous for not really truly being a coming together of fans of two particular teams, but a coming together of people who have wealth, who have access, who have power. And as a competition with tribal fans in the stands has really lost its luster. It's a one-off and for those of us who truly enjoy the competition of sports, for those of us that have rooting interests like I do in the Knicks and had a wonderful night last night watching that competition take place, it has lost its luster. I will just use a couple of phrases and maybe you can prod me to evolve my thinking, but it has become a sport led and branded as being the entire event has been covered by one of the seven capital sins, which is greed. And as such, I have a bad taste in my mouth over it. I will not attend it. I won't support a competition that is so been so badly managed. I won't say mismanaged because they got their intended effect, but so badly managed and so contrary to what I consider the highest ideals of sport.
Doug, this is a unique perspective, because at least when these games got bid out back in the good old days of 2020-ish, they were going to be sort of a festival of bringing some tradition and some international comedy back to the World Cup. And which we've had some bad ones. I mean, we had the one before last in Moscow, and in Russia. Then we went to Qatar and built stadiums for that, and played off calendar for it. And ultimately, this is an event that brings a lot of the world together, obviously in commercial enterprise. And when the United States, Canada, and Mexico submitted a tripartite bid, I think a lot of people were hailing that was going to be a good thing and maybe return to some joy of the sport that had been lost over the years. You're saying here that the joy of the sport seems long gone and it's been messed up. Is that where are you going to put the blame? Who gets the bulk of it?
Well, it's complicated, like a lot of things. The return of the World Cup to the platform in North America was hopefully, by those who exhibited any kind of altruism, a return to the great success that Alan Rothenberg and his associates wrought in 1994, the best attended World Cup ever. And there was some thought that by including the nations north and south of here and really making it a CONCACAF World Cup, that kind of feeling could be brought back and it could be a commercial success. I'm going to pause there and tell you that the international governing body for sport, for the sport of soccer, FIFA, is constituted as a non-for-profit in Switzerland. It is a Swiss non-for-profit. Almost from the announcement of the bid, it has turned its signature event that is about to take place in this country into a for-profit, not only for the institution, but for the extended family of fellow travelers to enrich themselves. So even obscure branches of that extended family, the railroads taking spectators to Foxborough from Boston, have taken what is normally a $15 train ticket, and for that day it becomes a $90 train ticket. The train ticket in New York to get to MetLife Stadium went from $16 or $17 initially to $150, and then they kind of compromised something out. everyone along that feeding trough has taken the opportunity to enrich themselves unfairly, in my view, unfair enrichment. And it is just an explosion of largesse that is incredibly distasteful to me. Take the city of New York, for example. There are two stadiums that I'm going to contrast right now. One of them being MetLife Stadium, where this incredible and horrible spectacle of a final is going to take place, with reputed tickets going for as much as seven figures, where you can't park. They shut down parking, so the only way of getting there is by limousine or by a rail ticket that costs $150. Just this horrendous explosion of cost that has taken the game away from the common man, where it should have stayed. This is a sport that was created for the common man to participate in and to witness, and has taken it to a level where, in this bifurcated economy that we live in, not only nationally but globally, there are haves and have-nots, and this has become an event for the haves. Contrast that with, and you can see the New York City skyline from MetLife Stadium if you face east. If you go to a place in Queens called the Metropolitan Oval, okay, which is a fabulous facility that was created so that the common man could have a place to compete and play in Queens. There were some people who I got involved with when I was commissioner who performed the Herculean task of bringing it up to modern day standards, and it still sits there today. And about 200 different teams participate and play, and, you know, kick each other's shins and chase the ball around. And it's the same sport, and it is done on a level which, like I say, is egalitarian rather than a sport that is designated just for upper classes. Let me just take one statistic to you. The average face value of a ticket for this World Cup coming up 4 years later is four times what it was in Qatar. Four times over the course of 4 years. And that does not include the secondary market, which is where an awful lot of people who are insiders are going to make an awful lot of money as a consequence of this horrendous inflation in price.
You brought up a number of really interesting points. One, that soccer, a game that has been popularized around the world, played in favelas, played in the streets, played in the backyards, played wherever it can be played, using the simplest of equipment, a ball and maybe something that constitutes a goal, has been you know, taken by plutocrats and been part of been atomized into a global economic structure now that only the haves can be a part of. I think that's a fascinating one. I'm not old enough to remember Pelé in the World Cup per se, but I am old enough to remember the first one I can remember in West Germany, with the West German team winning in the Olympic Stadium in Berlin, and ultimately the meaning of those. And the World Cup has had a lot of organic meaning attached to it. But it's also, FIFA has also been thought of as one of the more corrupt global organizations. Power and privilege, creating certain advantages in pay to play. Probably no accident that a number of the FIFA representatives happen to have homes in the Trump Tower here in the United States long before the main person who it's named for ascended to the presidency. Any thoughts on FIFA's role in this? And I still have a French student who probably won't speak to me because I said Sepp Blatter was one of the worst bagmen this side of Tony Soprano. He's still shocked that I could say such a thing as a sports professor.
Look, I have worked in and around soccer during the reign of three heads of FIFA, João Havelange, Sepp Blatter, and now Gianni Infantino. They run, and I would love for someone to challenge this even in court because I would love to stand up and give my views on this. But they run what is fundamentally a corrupt organization. It's a corrupt international organization. Now, so you can measure corruption in whatever way you can, and you and I have had long conversations over, in the business of trying to teach students, do you teach them to do the right thing legally? Is it morally? Is it ethically? What is happening is an ethical abomination, and it is has exploded with such a force that I think that my thoughts are is that there's going to be a backlash to this. The first of those FIFA grandees that I served under, which was João Havelange, a Brazilian who ultimately got indicted, and died in a form of disgrace. When Rothenberg came to him with a plan of creating a special slice of tickets for those people who had the means and wanted a special seat, and he wanted to charge $1,000 a seat for the final in very very narrow sections. Even Havelange said, "No, we can't do this," and he turned him down, and ultimately wouldn't let him sell a ticket for $1,000. What has occurred through the years and through the advent of weird stuff happening, like hedge funds getting involved in the sport and capitalism, unchecked capitalism going wild and letting the marketplace dictate. And what it's done is it's taken the everyman sport, right? The sport of the common man, the sport that is played in on fields in Red Hook in Brooklyn, and it's played with sometimes something representing a soccer ball, and it and but it but it's it develops a passion among young and old people in a global sense. It is truly the one global sport, and it has taken it and at least for this event that's taking place this summer, has ruined it.
Doug, I'm intrigued, and obviously I've certainly looked at the corruption that is FIFA and this kind of turning to where the money is in bags or in crypto or wherever we go with that. But I wanted just to see we're in the United States are in a unique place right now because we're at a place where corruption is most openly talked about in our political branches, and these games are going to come around this as we go. But I wondered if have you thought that the United States is pulled particularly unique political setting right now. We'll keep some names out of it as we go, but just the embrace of plutocracy and kleptocracy that's going on. Does that play into this event in any way in your mind?
It does to a degree. You have to remember that soccer is not alone in this. International sanctioning bodies in general, the people that John McCain went to war with over Salt Lake, Corruption of sports on a global level is something that has existed for decades. I mean, everyone talks about, the good heart amateurism of Avery Brundage. I got war stories to tell that say that maybe not so much, so that it has always been a feature of the international game. And it's done in a rather crude manner. FIFA, and I'm talking about days gone by, had an allocation system to national governing bodies. Okay, so that if you were among the, in the old days, 16 or whatever the right number was of teams that were invited to the World Cup, you got an allocation of 10 to 20,000 tickets that ostensibly were given to national federations to make sure that their fans had a seat in the contests that they were participating in. That was the overall overarching reason to give these ticket allocations at face value at an artificially low price. And what these national governing bodies did, including ours, by the way, they would take maybe 2,000 or 3,000 tickets and do a mail order and a lottery and come and get your tickets. And there's no one looking over their shoulder. Okay. The balance of them were taken by the people who controlled tickets, and they were scalped. And every 4 years, a bunch of guys got rich. And by a bunch of guys, I mean hundreds, of guys internationally got rich. And the ticket brokers knew who controlled the tickets in every place from the US to Nigeria to Turkey to Japan. And they would have deals made ahead of time to get the tickets off their hands. And no one accounted for anything. There were no one audited anything. And I have seen hotel rooms, with mounds of tickets and mounds of cash, and knowing full well what was going on. How do you stop that? I mean, I had a position of some power. I couldn't stop it, And so the institutional corruption that has existed for decades has allowed this to happen. Now, one additional interesting dynamic has occurred where the FIFA council, their legislative body of representatives throughout the world, used to have an involvement in this. Under Infantino, now everything is done by the president's office.
Oh,
It's
God.
all him.
We're
It's
gonna.
all him. It's all centralized. I mean, they maybe he consulted with the Federalist Society and their unitary president role and decided how to take power unto himself. But he has taken power unto himself. So, if ultimately someone is going to be called to blame, and I doubt that, that day of reckoning is going to happen, it resides there.
It's definitely
And
Infantino this time, right? Yep.
oh yeah.
Doug, Jeremy wanted. I have about three more follow-ups that I want to get on. We're talking to Doug Logan, the former founding commissioner of the MLS, and we're talking particularly about the World Cup and the things that make it distasteful to him this time around, and have sort of ruined an event that he loved and looked forward to. Jeremy, go ahead. You were going to hop in.
Yeah, Doug. So earlier you brought up your thoughts on FIFA and the FIFA structure itself, and you brought up how everyone has purchased tickets and scalped them in secondary market, and how $1,000 tickets or $10,000 or $20,000 tickets are now the norm. who's really at fault when it comes to everyone other than FIFA? Because isn't everyone like, oh, well, FIFA's doing it, we might as well capitalize to include local governments, changing mass transportation ticket prices, hotels charging exorbitant prices, stores selling bottled water for 100, time mar 100, times markup. What Who would you say outside of FIFA is at the biggest fault? Would you say it's the fan willing to buy the tickets and buy the bus tickets and to buy the bottle of water that's $20? Or would you blame someone in between, or is it ultimately FIFA?
We come out of a we all come out of a Judeo-Christian concept of right and wrong. And out of that concept of right and wrong, one of the very first things we do is we look to try and find the person or the individual to point the finger at. And instead of looking at the finger, we ought to be looking at the thumb, because it's all us. It's all us because we have allowed these systems, we have tolerated these systems, and they have fed into a celebrity culture, a culture where ethics is not taught or respected, and it's all of us. It's not, they do it because we allow them to do it. Okay? They do it because no one says, stop, I'm not going to do this anymore. They do it. There's probably going to be pockets of resistance, and there are going to be some games where the stands aren't full and everything else. The guys that are running this massive grift really don't care, because they will have made theirs, okay? So they really don't care about it. But until ultimately the witness, the patron, the media, the until there is a hue and cry, until smoking becomes a noxious issue to society, okay, and gets people to stop smoking cigarettes, okay, until people rise up and say no more. And that's why I am going to be a lonely voice and saying, not for me. I'm not paying a dime into this scam, okay? But I'm going to be very lonely, because for the most part, people that want to see, Germany play France, they're going to pay the price.
Doug, I wanted to get into a couple of things, and I've been in your old shop, the MLS, a few times, and I've always come away when I talk to the people, particularly about their marketing, particularly about their strategy of holding the rights to the Mexican national team and the inclusion that it brings, and the way it can spread the sport, that they always seem to have an eye on the future. Is this mistake, is this kind of to use the vernacular of soccer, is this sort of an own goal now that soccer, which could be ascendant in the United States and in North America to the degree that it isn't already in Mexico and isn't popular in Canada, is this an own goal on by our own grandees who could have gotten more from this?
Yeah, it probably is. It's if you talk privately to the people in the sport itself, they recognize that this is outrageous. There's a recognition that this is not only over the top, but is over the top of Everest, what is taking place. And it was very carefully, strategically thought out, with peace prizes and with Frequent visits to the White House. And I mean, this was well orchestrated so that the environment for this to take place was carefully cultivated over the course of the last 3 to 5 years. But I think that this may be, and it's really hard to look into the future, given the fact that the present changes so rapidly from one day to another. But this may be a bridge too far. This they may have taken this a bridge too far, and there's going to be a retrenchment, and there's going to be a backlash that is going to cause the pendulum to come and swing back the other way. I can't see it getting any worse than this. And I think that the pendulum may start to swing back, because what they will have done with their corruption is attack the foundation of the sport, which is exactly that, which is the Guatemalan kid that goes to bed with a soccer ball because he doesn't want to lose the feeling of the ball close to his body. You know, it is the feeling that after the 98 final where France, a wonderful match where Zidane and France beat Brazil, FIFA had a car for me after the match to take me back to the hotel. I took my two boys and I said, no, we're walking with the people. And we walked with a million people through the Champs-Élysées to the Arc de Triomphe. And I said, this is what the game is all about. Look at the joy. Look at the joy on the people who are dressed well and people who are not dressed well and people who are rich and people who are poor. And it's got to be a return to something like that. So I'm hopeful. I think, Bob, you know me better than my other two new friends, but I think you know me to be an optimist. Right. And the optimist in me says that we've gone too far.
I appreciate that tremendously. We're hearing about this event the same way we've heard about a lot of events, that hotels are, I guess the difference is, unlike Brazil or Qatar, the facilities are built. We don't have to worry about those taking place. They're already here. But we're talking a lot about the hotels not being filled, people not coming. I agree with, for the first time in my life, I agree with Sepp Blatter, who said, watch it on TV. Don't go to it. The United States is too toxic right now. Is the United States being set up for a fall in this games too? And will they blame our administration for the failure?
Yeah, but they're blaming us for a whole lot of stuff these days. So you just throw that on the.
Throw that on the fire into
the furnace, and it's just another way of being blamed for an awful lot of things. We've gone out of our way to poke people in the eye, and this is just another poke in the eye. I think it's interesting that Sepp is saying don't go. This is particularly given the nature of his tenure at the helm and the questionable things that he did while he was there. I think he is lucky that he escaped a reckoning for a lot of his actions. And now he's found someone that it was worse than he was, so he's throwing rocks. I mean, so it's fascinating to watch the way these people operate.
It's not a shock that leaders sometimes who've had rocky tenures or particularly coarse tenures would always want to be followed by somebody who was worse, who fails more.
Absolutely,
that's not a shocker there.
It's It's called Hudson County politics in New Jersey, right? The reformer always needs to be reformed, right?
Doug, I've learned in teaching at Seton Hall the last few years that there is no corruption like New Jersey corruption. I haven't lived in Nevada yet, but I'm waiting for that one as I go. As always, Doug, you're fascinating and spot on. And maybe I'm more an Olympist than I am just definitively an innate fan of the beautiful game. But I was in Paris and on the ground, and I saw the Olympics capture a city. I saw the Olympics actually really re-catch their momentum in a way after having been inflated and deflated after Sochi and some failures along the way. I've caught the same feeling out of Milan that they were very successful as well in the Winter Games. Your point is an interesting one to me. What might have the Olympics learned that FIFA may need to learn now?
I'm not so sure that wasn't just transactional. I think that there is the business of sports attracts some interesting people, and ethical conduct usually is not part and parcel with it. There have been some great, great sportsmen in this country, Lamar Hunt and others who, you know, you could almost write a praecious on doing good from how he conducted himself. There are an awful lot of people involved in the sport that have questionable motives, and it's a difficulty sometime
is that just me?
In reconciling, you know, what's going to occur. I think that we've got this as a problem the same way we've got a problem with business in general, with regard to having a generation of executives who perhaps don't conduct themselves as ethically as they should.
Doug Logan, thank you so much for your thoughts and for joining us today at Leaders Under Fire in Sports. Before we finish this episode, I want to put Jeff on the spot here. Jeff, do you have a closing question to ask Doug before we finish today's episode?
I always enjoy hanging out with Doug. I think I don't so much have a question, but a sense of gratitude. Doug, you've been there. You've been there, you've seen that, you've done that, and you have a wealth of experience that we are all better for having had the opportunity to hang out with you. So honestly, just thank you for hanging
out
with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your kind words, and it's always a pleasure to spend time virtually with kindred spirits and sometimes we finish each other's sentences. We think pretty much the same way, and I'm delighted to contribute to what I consider to be is a beautiful altruistic communications vehicle to get a message across in these important times. So, Jeremy, thanks to you too.
You've been listening to Leaders Under Fire in Sports by Culture in Sports. These moments under pressure don't just shape headlines, they shape people. They shape organizations and the cultures they leave behind. Thanks for joining me. I'm Jeff Chatterton, joined with Bob Boland and Dr. Jeremy Piasecki, and our special guests as we've examined what leadership looks like when it truly matters. If this conversation challenged the way you think about leadership in sports, we invite you to continue to learn with us at cultureinsports.com, because influencing positive change starts with how leaders respond when they're under fire.